Hey y'all, you're tuned into Assigned Sex Unarchived. I'm your non-binary cousin, Sean Dawson, and this is a safe space where we're honest about what it means to show up as Black, trans, and genderqueer. Last time we linked up, we talked about transphobia in the Black community. So today, we're going to shift the energy a little bit. I'm sitting down again with Nandi K, and we're talking about Black trans joy and celebration. We're going to sit with joy next to grief, talk about the people and the projects that keep us going, and send a little love note forward to the Black trans kids coming after us. Let's get into it.
So I think the first time I remember really being in my body was probably like 4 years ago. And it wasn't necessarily a positive feeling, but it was a feeling of, I know how I feel. I know that if I felt safe, my body would not feel like this. I know that when I feel safe, my body feels a different way. And for me, that was really profound as someone who has had to hide my feelings for a long time and then lost that connection to what they even are. So that was like 4 years ago. So pretty new for me.
That didn't sound like a happy moment. I was asking for Black joy.
It was happy for me because I had never been able to name that before. There's a joy in being able to name your feelings when you didn't even know how to distinguish them per se before. I was really, really happy because when I could recognize that, then I could act to treat myself accordingly and keep myself safe and do the right thing for myself.
I get it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think maybe I was thinking about that differently. I was thinking about, for me, it was like, I used to always have this thing with, like with my hair, where, because my mom was a hairdresser, and mom always did my hair, and I remember, like, growing up, like, as I got older, I preferred to have my hair, like, in, like, shorter cuts. Mm-hmm. And everybody would be like, that's, like, very, like, masculine, like, presenting. And I used to, like, really feel a way about that. I'm like, oh, they calling me a man. I didn't like it. Like, I was really uncomfortable with it. And as I got, like, older, and it wasn't, like, 4 years ago. I think it may be, like, it was around the time when we first met, actually, when I cut all my hair off.
Oh, man.
And I was like, oh, like, I was like, this is it. Like, this is me. Like, it was the first time I had cut all of my hair off and was, like, really comfortable, like, in my body and, like, who I was. And
you
didn't
mean
really
when you, like, hacked it off with the scissors in the mirror that time?
Yeah, that time. Oh. And then I had to get a haircut.
And time. Then you cut it all off. Okay, mm-hmm. I was just trying to make sure we're talking about the same
thing. Yep, we're talking about that moment.
I love when you get a haircut.
I do, too. Mm-hmm. Like, I like not having no hair. It's just that when you go into that phase where you got to grow it out, because eventually I'm gonna be like, I want some hair because my head is cold. Is that. So it's like, for me, it's like I either like to have long hair or no hair. Right now I'm in my bald-headed hoe phase where I'm just like.
I mean, you're not that bald-headed. Your hair.
I'm kind of bald-headed. I'm kind of
bald. But your hair is, but you're in a grow out phase. Like, yeah. You're not bald. You didn't just cut your hair. It's been a couple years. I like that story. I think for me, when it comes to how I present myself, that's a big part of who I am. I used to be a stylist. I have always cared about the way that I look, and I have never let other people dictate what that means. But that didn't really ground me in my body. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think my moment of joy is around feeling inside my body as opposed to how it's perceived by others and how I think I look. Because how I look is an ongoing curation for me. I'm in costume. I'm in perpetual costume.
That's real. That's true. It's very true about you.
Yeah.
how would you explain like Black trans joy to like your nephew, like a 6-year-old, if they asked you what it was?
Oh, wow. Black trans joy. I would just say a Black trans person existing, doing what they want to do. A Black trans person at the grocery store unassailed is Black trans joy to me. Yeah, just being able to be.
Yeah, I think
without
I
being
would.
Assaulted. It's honestly, yeah. It's sad. It's kind of sad, but it feels like it's just so little.
Yeah, I think I would just start maybe with like a video of like a trans person getting ready, like doing their makeup, or getting dressed with some music, because like that's them in their moment, becoming themselves.
I couldn't show my nephew any of the trans people I follow. They're too adult. But
why couldn't you?
They're too adult. Their content, you know.
Oh.
Yeah.
You know, I was recently taking a walk with Kalina. Mm-hmm. Kalina's my niece. And we were talking and she was like, I think we started talking about you, and I had said like they, and it was like, why do you keep saying they? And I was like, Kalina, we've been through this.
Yes.
I was like, Nandi, I use they. And she was telling me, she was like, you know, that's just so confusing because that's not how you're supposed to talk. Like, it doesn't sound right. I was like, oh, no. Kalina, that's not true. She was like, why wouldn't you say she or he? I was like, because some people want you to say they. And then she was like, oh, okay. And she left it alone.
Really, kids really get, this is how the conversation always goes with Kalina, honestly.
Yeah.
Every time I have the conversation with Kalina, it goes pretty much exactly the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Where she asks a clarifying question,
mm-hmm.
explains, oh, like this, I say yes, that's the end of it.
Remember that time
kids really
where,
get it.
She kept calling pig a he. And I was like, pig. I was like, pig is a girl and she's a she. And I was like, why do you keep calling her a he? And she said, because it's a brown dog.
Yes. She is handsome, isn't she? Not that dogs have genders, right?
Right.
That's just us like projecting our own things onto our
projecting.
But I would say our sweet pig is a trans dog.
Would you?
Very masculine presenting, very feminine personality.
Okay, so it's time for a little Black trans and genderqueer history. Today we're centering the story of Audre Lorde.
When you live on the edge of any structure, you have to know that survival is not theoretical. I know that as a Black woman, I know that as a lesbian. Whenever you are conscious that your identity is on the edge, survival becomes very, very real. And once you live on the level of survival as a reality, you learn that you have to value and critique the particulars all the time.
Audre was born in 1934 in Harlem to strict West Indian immigrant parents who were very much on their "you better not embarrass his family" energy. She was the youngest of three girls and grew up in a strict Catholic household, going to Catholic schools where she was sometimes the only Black girl in the room. And from a very young age, she knew she was different. When people asked her how she was doing, she'd answer in poems that she'd memorize. And when no poem existed for what she felt, she just wrote one herself. That's who little Audre Lorde was.
I know a lot of things that happened to me when I was younger that made me feel crazy all the time had a lot to do with what was going on around me that didn't even belong to me. They were never acknowledged, but here are these people. It's like the persona, but the personas were actual, tangible
when you feel them, and they assault you like ghosts constantly.
But when you proceed to act on what is actually occurring,
then they tell you you're either crazy, perverted, drunk, or weird.
Yeah.
As an adult, Audrey started naming herself out loud. Black,
feminist, lesbian, poet.
She worked as a librarian in New York public schools, got degrees from Hunter College in Columbia, and then stepped into teaching at places like Tougaloo College.
I had never been south before, further south in Washington. The opportunity to go into the south, and of course you remember what was happening in Jackson, Mississippi. This is 1968, the beginning of 1968. Tougaloo was still under attack, right? As a center for the Freedom Riders, there were night riders shooting up the campus, you know, every other week practically. And working with black students, working with students who really questioned and forced me to question what we were doing, how did we move, and what was the place, for instance, of our writing, of our poetry.
Her most famous line, "Your silence will not protect you," wasn't just something she wrote. It was how she moved through the world. She refused to make herself smaller to make anybody comfortable.
Survival is not a one-time decision. It's not a one-time act. It's something that goes on and on and on. And you make a commitment in the same way I make a commitment to myself. I make a commitment to my working. I make a commitment to my survival.
Her personal life was layered too. She married Edwin Rollins, a white gay man, in the early 60s, had two kids, and later divorced. She built long-term partnership and community with women like Frances Clayton, a white professor she met while teaching in Mississippi. And she stayed in conversation with black women and lesbians who were being pushed out of every room that was supposed to be for them.
Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
My existence does not deny you yours. But
don't you know what I'm saying? I'm saying everybody's problems seem to be just as much of a crisis. And if you're so involved in your own, that on the same hand, the other person isn't going to be interested in helping you out of yours. If you know what I mean. The same way you seem to be rejecting the fact that the other prejudices do exist, or that yours seem to be worse.
No, but you keep on imposing that construction on us. Nothing that we have said admits of that conclusion.
Yes, when you said you're the ones that were dragged over here, this and that, you were ignorant of the fact that maybe someone else did have it harder, and that yours was the plight. You know,
nobody said that. I said that mine was the one I was dealing with. I declined to answer the question the way you posed it because I didn't like the framework. I am not concerned about whose discrimination is the greater or the lesser.
When mainstream publishing kept ignoring black and brown feminist work, especially queer voices, she just didn't complain about it. In the 1980s, she helped build Kitchen Table Women of Color Press with Barbara Smith and others. Because if the table doesn't have a seat for you, apparently you just build the whole table.
And we decided that each one of us, in our own way, had spoken of the inability to get what we had to say out. Or having heard the night before so many wonderful women share their work with us that we knew would never be shared. And we thought, this is the time. With our necks in the noose, with Reaganomics sweeping the country, with homophobia and sexism and ageism and racism totally on the rise, this was the time for us to do.
Then in 1977, she was diagnosed with breast cancer. She had a mastectomy, and instead of going quiet, she wrote the cancer journals. She refused to wear a prosthesis. She wrote plainly about her pain, fear, and anger, but also she wrote about wanting other women going through it to see her, to see themselves, because the stories that existed were not built for her.
I had a biopsy for a breast tumor, which they told me was probably malignant. As it turned out, it was not. But I spent, there was an interim of about 3.5 weeks between the time they told that I was to go in and the time I went into the hospital. And during that time, I completed the whole trip of dealing with mortality, of the rage, the fury, and so forth.
And through all of that, the cancer, the organizing, the parenting, she kept writing. The Black Unicorn, Zombie, Sister Outsider. Books where she broke down how race, gender, class, and sexuality don't exist separately. They stack. She was doing intersectionality before it even had that name. Audrey didn't identify as trans, and she was working in a time when trans organizing wasn't really centered the way it is now. But her ideas cracked something open. When she wrote about the erotic, as a deep source of power inside of us, she wasn't just talking about sex. She was talking about that feeling of being fully yourself in your body. And that language has given Black trans and genderqueer people a way to claim their joy as something serious, something political, something worth defending.
And what I wanted to talk about today was the erotic as a source of that power, and how urgent it is that we recognize that within ourselves and that we not confuse the pornographic with the erotic. The name of this is uses of the erotic as power.
She showed that telling the truth about who you are, building chosen family, and creating spaces where your people can see themselves isn't being extra. It's survival. Audrey died in 1992 after her cancer return, but before she passed, she took on an African name, Gamba Adisa, meaning warrior, she who makes her meaning known. So when we talk about Black trans joy and celebration this week, her work is in the background of all of that. A Black trans or genderqueer kid can pick up one of her books today, see that name, hear that voice, and feel like, wow, somebody was making space for me before I even got here.
We're going to be afraid because we were programmed to be afraid, right? And we can learn to work when we're afraid, same way we can learn to work when we're tired. And that, out of that, this poem arose. And it's called A Litany for Survival. And actually, the title of it is A Litany for Survival number 40. Because you should know that, of course, survival is an ongoing thing.
You have a lot of chosen family.
Oh, man, that's like all I have. I mean, that's not true.
No, it's not.
But a majority.
Am I your chosen family?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Wow. Maybe you're not. Maybe I'm finding out right now in this episode that maybe actually you're my chosen family, but maybe I'm not your chosen
You're my chosen family, too.
I don't know if that's true. And now, if you're listening, you decide. Get in the comments. Do y'all think that Sean has chosen me as their family based on that line of questioning?
And how does chosen family show up?
The same to me, the same way that family does, that not chosen family does, except, you know, they choose to do it. Like, we choose each other. We weren't forced together by proximity or sometimes that's how we ended up together, but we're not forced together by blood or biology. We met each other in some turn of events. We choose to be in each other's lives. For me, I think I let people show up how it's best to show up. Everybody isn't the best showing up for everything.
Mm-mm.
So I'm like, you show me how you show up, and then that's how I will expect you to show up. I like for my family to tell me who they are, and then that's what I expect.
So is there a difference between like your chosen family and your friends?
To me, no.
No, okay.
For me,
because I was going to ask, I was like, does chosen family, are you more like lenient with your chosen family? Can they beat up on you more? Can they be terrible people? And you're like, that's just my family, so I got to deal with it.
No, and I don't, but I also don't tolerate that with my family.
I mean, yeah, real.
Yeah, I don't tolerate that with my family, so I wouldn't tolerate it. And it actually kind of happened the opposite way for me. My chosen family kind of has always treated me better than my real family. And that helped me realize, why would I tolerate that for my real family if these people who I met, who don't know me from Adam, you know, if they treat me nice and well, why would I let my family treat me bad? I mean, do you want to talk about like how hard it is to continue to keep up relationships and even make new ones as like life goes on? Because I think we've both lost some friendships and had some relationships change in really deep ways.
I have very few friends. I think I can count them all on one hand. And that is because is so much work maintaining relationships, I think. So I'm always very, like, I just don't be jumping out there trying to, like, meet new people and, like, meet new friends, because I don't feel like I barely can juggle the relationships I got right now. So if it doesn't feel, like, natural, I don't really, like, I'm just not willing to go, like, the extra, put any extra effort. But the relationships I have now, they are very solid. I feel like I know who they are. And like you said earlier, like, I know how they can show up for me. And they're all very, very different. I was talking to someone recently about, like, how my, like, friend groups, like, I don't think I could put all of my friends in one room together.
I don't
think we'd all get along.
No, definitely not. I'm like, I damn near don't like your friends. So,
yeah, like, we all couldn't hang out together, but each of them serve a purpose. Each of them serve a purpose. And when I need them, like, I can hit them up at, like, mm-hmm. 2 a.m. or, like, whatever it is. Like, I know they'll be there. But I...
That's why I don't go too hard, because I'm like, but they can also get the knife if they get caught slipping around me. And that's really, like, the reason I don't like your friends is...
Well, who am I? You're going to kill my friends?
Yeah.
You would, though. Yeah.
Yeah, because I'm like, don't let me catch you slipping on my boo. Don't be... I don't forgive. Like,
I don't forgive either. I don't forgive either.
No, you don't. But no, I don't forgive in a much more tangible way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're like, if I don't forgive you, you can't be around me. But I also think that's the autism sometimes. Like, I really struggle with kind of, like...
Yeah, I like... thinking. I feel like... I think that's, like, you were saying, like, with chosen family, how, like, sometimes we have... Well, I won't say sometimes. Like, when you're, like, growing up, you're, like... You have these, like, abusive relationships with your parents, which kind of form all of your relationships later in life, and you just start tolerating shit you shouldn't. But with my friends, like, we've definitely had some fallouts, but not to a point where I'm just like, I'm never talking to you again. It's just like, oh, I can't depend on you to do that thing. Like, I know how you're going to show up for me here.
Real. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Gotta let them so, be who they are.
Best people. Like, I let people be who you are. Mm-hmm. Now, if you do, like, some wild shit, I will. Like, I have had some friends that, like, we're still cool, but we might go, like, a year or so without talking because you did something fucked up and I was mad and I never forget. I never forget.
But why still be cool? See, this is what I'm saying. Where we differ is, like, why would I still be cool? We're not
because
cool.
People like apologize and I have a thing. Like, for me, I know that I also think it's problematic to never forgive. But I know that's, like, a part of me. Like, I always, like, grudges.
Why?
Like, I hold deep, deep, deep grudges.
But a deep never forgiving is not the same as holding a deep grudge. Being like, I don't fuck with you for what you did and I don't fuck with you forever is not holding a grudge. Like,
but if they came to you and was like, I'm sorry for that thing I did.
Okay. I'm glad you're sorry. You can't be in my life. Okay, you're sorry. We know you're sorry. That's why you're not in my life anymore. Like, why weren't you sorry in the moment? Why are you now sorry now that you've suffered consequences? Like, the timing matters, too, when it comes to, like, conflict resolution. Timing matters a lot. You can't let a year go by and then come and apologize to me. I've moved on.
I mean, no, I'm not saying they apologize after a year. I'm saying they apologize and I was still mad and didn't talk to their ass for a year. And then I thought about it and I was like, Sean, don't be like that. So, okay. Because the episode is still about joy.
Yes, we're talking about happiness. Things that bring us happiness.
But also, we got to be real and to say that, like I feel like joy and grief do have the same body.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And every year in November, on the Trans Day of Remembrance. Everybody comes together and they read all of the trans people that were killed for the previous year. And I feel like even in moments of grief, there is still like a little bit of joy there too. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes me think of the Richard Smallwood funeral.
Yeah, most funerals, actually.
Well, most Black funerals.
Yes.
Well, obviously, we're not talking about white funerals. Anyway, this show is not for white people. So.
Because you have to think about, like, let's say the person that drove, like, 5 hours to be in that room, or, mm-hmm. like, the person is doing the makeup before the ceremony, mm-hmm. or, like, the meal everybody has after, mm-hmm. and everybody's, like, sitting close and laughing. Uh-huh. Even if they're crying a little bit.
They call it a celebration of life.
A celebration of life, yeah.
I think it makes it so much sweeter because I actually went to a reading recently of people sharing like some works in progress. And all of them, one of the short stories was about the death of a trans person, but it was such a beautiful story because in a story from the perspective about death, it was about the fact that she lived. Mm-hmm. And that's how joy and grief kind of live in the same body when it comes to death and people passing away. Is also, yes, they're not here with us now, but also they lived. They touched us. They shared themselves with us. And that also is so special. And as long as we have that, in some ways, parts of them won't ever die. And I think that's always really beautiful.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah.
How does joy help you survive loss?
Grief, that hoe got hands.
She did. She just be popping up.
Yeah, she just be popping mm-hmm. up out of nowhere. You could just be having a regular day. You could just be scrolling on social media. Mm-hmm. Now, all of a sudden, boom, bam, bam, you just remember that there's that person that you can never call again. And I think that when I reach for the joys of some of those things, for me, a lot of it is music. A lot of things for me are music. Yeah. And I know in some of my grief, there have been times where I felt like there was music that was lost to me forever because I could never talk to the person again who would know it. But then, like, little things happen, and those songs have been slowly coming back to me, and that's been really joyful. And making the grief not so deep, like, in along with time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's bittersweet.
It is. I lost a cousin a few years ago, and that music channel that I always have playing in the background. Well, now we don't have any music playing in the background, but there was always, like, after school, we would go to my aunt's house and we would play, we would watch, like, 106 in Park. And it was just, like, it's after school, like, music videos, and we would just watch it all day. And that channel that we used to have on, I don't remember, it's like a Samsung. Like
it's
R&B.
One of the Samsung TV channels.
It's one of the Samsung.
Like Excite Music or something like that.
Yeah. So I remember like right after she had passed, and like every time I would like walk in the living room, I would hear like one of the songs. And I'd be like, oh my. And sometimes it would make me sad, but sometimes it would also make me happy. Yeah. It would be funny, especially like there's this one song by Aretha Franklin, A Rose Is Still a Rose. I don't know why. That song, like, my cousin loved that song.
A banger.
Is it?
Yes, and it was also written by Lauryn Hill.
Are there any, like, Black trans artists that pop up top of your head, like, any music you listen to?
Here's the thing. I don't know how people identify.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know how people identify. But there is an artist named Arlo Parks.
Arlo Parks.
They're British and Nigerian, it looks like.
I think you told me about this person.
Yeah. They have pretty dope music. If you like The Internet or Sid, the kid from Odd Future, it has that kind of vibe. If you like my music, it'll... But it has that kind of like electronic R&B, very like all R&B vibe. Mm-hmm. I really like them. I would also say Sid the Kid. Oh, Michaela J, who played Blanca on Pose,
she has sings music?
Down.
Oh, I gotta check that out. I didn't know that.
She sings down. Ooh, she can sing. Angelica Ross also sings, but I don't think she's put out a lot of music. That's also my wife.
I recently heard her doing some voice acting, and I thought that was pretty dope.
Yeah, she has a great voice.
She has an amazing voice, and she's like a Black trans creator that I get excited about because she's everywhere.
She's so talented.
I think she's so talented. I mean, and she started, like, I was looking her up. Like, she started, like, Pose, American Horror Story. And then she, like, left Hollywood. Like, she's done with that now. And now she's in politics.
Yes, she's on Butch Ware's campaign.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's his communications director.
And she's a tech. She's a techie. Yeah, like, I love her.
Yeah, same. I've loved her for a very long time. I have been, when I found out that she had started Black Girls Code, I was swooning.
Mm-hmm. I remember.
Yeah, those are some really great. But yeah, Angelica Ross is really.
Is there any other like Black trans creator that gives you joy?
I don't know. I feel like if I was more. Black trans creators who give me joy.
Or projects. I think I'm very, very late, but I recently came across this project called the Okra Project. And I was this is so dope.
I knew about the Okra Project in New York City. I remember when it first started. I knew some people that worked with the Okra Project when they were just like doing meals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was like right around the time when we first met.
Yeah, they've been around for a while.
Yeah, when we first met was when I first started hearing about the Okra Project, like 2017. Yeah, the Okra Project is super dope.
Yeah.
They do grants. Yeah, they do a lot of really cool stuff. Dominique Morgan, what am I thinking? Imagine. My God, on today, I almost left her out. She is just, she used to be head of the Okra Project.
Oh.
Now she is head, she is the person who worked with T.S. Madison on the T.S. Madison Starter House as well. Okay. She works with some kind of giant, like, philanthropy fund. But also she just talks her shit online. She does a lot of commentary on current events and things that are going on. She's a brandy enthusiast and she's super funny.
What do you wish you could have seen or heard when you were younger?
As a trans person?
As a trans person.
I wish that who I knew sooner that who I was, especially gender-wise, was up to me. I spent quite a bit of time doing what I thought I was supposed to do. I came out late. I think it was late, and I was 25. I know people come out later, but I was probably gay the entire time. When I look back, I just see, like, I never fit any of the things, like, girl or straight. And so I wish that I would have known that I, very young, that's like, hey, whoever you are is up to you. You don't have to do what people say. You can just be who you are.
Yeah. I wish I could have seen, just seen, like, in person, like, another gender nonconforming person besides, like, on TV. Because I grew up, like, in the South. And I think the first time I saw a trans person was on Maury or, like, Jerry Springer.
Yeah, Maury, like, for sure.
Yeah, like, that was...
I guess if it's a woman or a man...
Yeah, I don't remember any like gender nonconforming people like around me like growing up. I do remember like some gay men.
See, like in church. My mama mm-hmm. used to play the piano at a bunch of pageants. And when I was younger, I didn't know what pageants were because I wasn't in the queer world. But now that I'm older, and I can put the dots together. My mom used to play in drag pageants. Like,
that's crazy.
One of her best friends, who died from AIDS, he used to do drag pageants. So I think my mom's friend's death really affected her. And I think the AIDS epidemic as a whole really affected a really big group of people in a profound way. Where I think if my mom's friend hadn't passed away, I would have a very different life. And I would have been around way more queer people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't really around any queers.
They be in church, though.
That's where I'm saying the ones I can think of that I was like, something's different there. They were in church.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, almost every minister of music at every church that I went to was a gay black man, except for one.
All right, y'all. That's all I got for today. If you want to connect with Nandi, you can find them on Instagram, Facebook, and Blue Sky at Nandi, KAYYY. The clips you heard from Audre Lorde in today's episode came from a few sources. The 1982 Blanche Cook interview, the 1979 WBAI radio interview with Judy Simmons, and a 1974 reading at the San Francisco State Poetry Center. All the links are in the show notes, so you can go listen to the full recordings yourself. If this episode dragged you a little bit, or if it hugged you a little bit, please share it with someone you love. You can find me, your non-binary cousin Sean Dawson, on all platforms at IMS Dawson. Y'all be safe out there. Thank you.